time to deliver, they fall flat on their ridiculous faces. Enter LA Talk Radio, a cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk station that delivers totally original content without any commercials. Log on to LATalkRadio.com and get involved with the best talk radio station on the internet. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Easily Offended by Stuff on the Radio.
Mr. Easily Offended by Stuff on the Radio.
On the drive to work, you tuned to a wacky, zany morning show and heard them say something distasteful. You can't believe your ears. You were just shocked by a shock jock.
Isn't that what a shock jock does?
Now, you're gonna do something about it.
Get that monster fired, yeah.
So the next time you see a guy protesting your favorite morning show because it messed with his PC sensibilities, exercise your First Amendment rights and give a single finger salute to Mr. Easily Offended by Stuff on the Radio, a real American hero.
Mr. Easily Offended by Stuff on the Radio.
You know, there is this thing called a tuner, and it actually lets you change the radio station. Isn't that incredible?
Get ready for the best morning show on any kind of radio. Broadcasting live from the palatial studios of LA Talk Radio, get ready for Sam and Kara in the morning. Give Sam and Kara a call at 323-203-0815. And now, here are your hosts, Sam and Kara.
It's Sam and Kara, Tuesday, May 25th. Welcome to the show. Kara is just ready.
You know, it's just not. It's not going to come together right now. I'm just have to figure it out later.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about as good as it gets. Are you okay with this?
Yeah. The good thing is you're not on TV, so you don't have to worry about how you
look. Do I
look
that bad
much.
Right now?
No, not at all. Okay. Not at all. You're looking nice. Your cheeks are rosy, and you're ready to go.
Got a coffee, guys. It was one of those mornings. Rolled out of bed. I looked over. It said 8:15. I usually leave around 8:15.
Wow.
I was like, damn.
So you had to rush.
But I still managed to put something cute on because I just don't like looking like I'm homeless.
Uh-huh. Good.
This is not my thing.
Thank you for being considerate.
So I have a really cute little outfit on. Did half my makeup in the car, and then half of it's lost somewhere.
Yeah. Are you going to talk in the microphone? Or?
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. I would think by now you'd know that, right? That's why you have headphones, so you know what you sound like.
I sound a little bit like a man, let's be honest, because I've been under the weather. So I thought it was getting really better, and it's been a little bit bad today, but... I don't know if I sound like this.
I'd hate to meet a man that sounds like that.
Yeah, Kathleen Turner.
Yeah.
Hi. I've been reading your novel all day. I gotta take a second.
Yeah, she's got a pretty sexy voice, but she doesn't look very good anymore. Like she hit the wall.
You know that happens in life.
I guess it does.
And it's okay. It's part of life, right?
Yeah, I guess, you know, but sometimes I guess we're accustomed to...
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's
movie
like...
Movie stars
especially
not growing up.
When you see people in their prime and you see them in their heyday and they're rocking, it's almost like a double-edged... It's like a double-edged sword because they're screwing themselves.
Yeah.
Now they're never going to be able to look that way again. And that's what people are going to remember them by.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think that we're particularly hard on... You know, aging on women, right? Right.
I guess.
No, I guess. Oh. No, exactly. Oh, I think so. No, yeah, you know.
Yeah. Is it true that men get actually better with age and women do not? I wonder why that is.
Men actually, because if you think about aging, wrinkles, and it can make a man look more distinguished.
Mm.
Whereas a woman, it doesn't go with femininity.
I see. Okay. She's like eating a fucking muffin and is hoping to be able to talk.
Well, you shouldn't have had them out there.
I know.
I mean, I'm like, I'm generally good not eating junk food.
Yeah, are they good?
Yeah, they're pretty good. They're still like soft.
Yeah, like chocolate cupcakes or muffins, whatever you want to call them.
I call it good.
Yeah?
I think sex and chocolate really go hand in hand.
Really? How would you know?
You're such a dork.
Listen to you. I mean, I'd never
You're
expect
so
that
funny.
From you.
Yeah, right. I've told you I've had sex, you punk.
Yeah, you have.
It.
So, did you try it with chocolate too?
Yeah, I've done that with chocolate one time. I have actually.
Yeah, chocolate is good. Sex is good. I agree. They could go together. You know? Am I going to sit here and talk to myself while you're eating?
Well, I mean, just give me 2 seconds. Can you relax?
Listen, I can go without eating until 1 o'clock. You can do the same, no?
Yeah, no, I can't.
No?
I want to fight.
And you're drinking a Frappuccino. You know how sweet those things are?
Mm, so good.
They are good, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But they're not like the same ones like they make for you.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, the ones in the bottle.
No, they're more like an iced coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to wait
good,
till
I'm good,
you
I'm good, I'm back. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, guys.
It's a little bit rude, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, but I'm going for it today.
You don't give a shit.
Well, not right now.
I see, okay.
But you're right, it is rude.
Yeah.
We know each other, though. We've been...
I suppose we do.
I think we've been a lot ruder than that. So, anyway, good morning, Sam. How are you feeling?
Good morning. I'm feeling great, and we're going to have a couple of guests today, one on the phone. If you remember Noelle.
Oh, I love her, yeah.
She loves to come on the show, so we're going to have her.
Well, she's so informed and very articulate.
Right. And I am going to ask her about, because, you know, she's also a model, or she used to be, and she's hot. You know,
she's hot.
So it was sort of like, you know, I don't know how she reconciled that with her being... like a political strategist.
Well, how old is she now?
I don't know how old she is. I wouldn't ask her. But she's probably in her 40s, 30s.
Yeah, she's very beautiful.
30s, 40s.
You know, I mean, there's no reason why you can't be beautiful. If you've noticed, I think there's been, I mean, there's constantly been a trend with being hotter. And I think the news anchors are getting hotter, and they're having these younger girls, you know.
Yeah. I know. When you watch CNN or Fox, it's like, you know, cookie cutter, you know. They all look
the
same.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah.
It's like hot. Hot makes us smarter. Hot means you're going to listen to us more.
Exactly. Well, at least you're going to watch us. So that's what
for
they
sure.
care about, you know.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But you know what, when I see like newscasts where they don't have such pretty women, it sort of like stands out, you know, cuz you sort of expect it now.
And that, what do you so you stop and watch the ugly ones?
I stop watching it and I change channel to the cute ones.
Good to know you're really concerned with them.
I am. I'm very shallow. You should know that by now.
You actually are shallow, but you're actually have a big heart too.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to agree with me, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm just being true. Did you get my message back yesterday?
I did.
We don't need to say that on the air, actually.
Why? That's pretty good.
I don't want to insult anybody that's come on.
You're not insulting anybody.
Sam sent me a message yesterday, and he went, "Kara, we've got a couple days. I need you to book them. Make sure that they're hot." I'm like, okay, it's radio, Sam.
I said preferably hot.
Preferably hot. And I wrote back, yeah, when's the last
time? It is radio, but I have to look at them, you know.
Yeah, and I'm like, when's the last time you brought in a hot guest?
Yeah. Well, I did. I brought a couple guys in that you liked, didn't I?
Oh, for me?
Yeah.
You brought guys? When? Who?
Well, I'm not going to go into that, but I have.
A couple hot men for me? No, yeah. I don't think that's happened.
Okay.
Reese was hot.
Okay.
Hi, Reese.
So there's one.
Reese was hot.
Yeah. Okay, that's it.
I mean, then I remember everybody. I mean, not that they weren't hot. I mean, everybody's a decent looking person, but I remember them being like,
yeah.
I'm a hot guy.
Yeah. Well,
is this how? This is so stupid. It was funny. Yeah. Reese is a good looking dude.
Yeah. You liked him?
Yeah, I really thought he was really cool.
Good.
Good. Yeah. Very cool dude.
Yeah. So how are you doing this morning? Did you have a busy day yesterday?
I did. I've gotten so much done with my comedy. I actually want to send it to you and get your opinion on it. It's my promo kit that I'm sending out to booking agents for colleges and things like that.
Yeah, you want my opinion? I'm going to tear it apart.
Well, that's okay. I mean, as long as it's constructive.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't tear it apart.
No, I mean, like, if you
if it's not good, I'm going to let you know.
Exactly. I mean, I'm only doing what I know how to do on my own.
Right.
And so it's not going to be... I mean, I think for people that have seen it that aren't into... Mm-hmm. editing or aren't into, you know, web design or whatever, they're like, oh, it looks great, it looks professional, and I think it's fun. But I mean, again, I know I'm limited because I don't know.
So you managed to learn how to do it, huh?
Yeah.
Good for you. I'm really proud of
you. Thanks, man. I mean, I'm like, what am I gonna do? I want to get this stuff going.
Yeah.
Make some kizash, and then I'll go back and soup it up.
Maybe on your dating site you can write, you know, looking for a guy who can do video editing, and just let them do it.
I can have all my criteria. Do you like editing? Then I think we get along great for about 3 dates.
Yeah.
Do or however long the product takes. And then I'd be like, do you like funding people's music projects? We'd get along great. Do you like being somebody's agent? We would be great together.
Do I want to be someone's agent? I wouldn't even know where to start.
No, I'm talking about like put that on my dating site.
Mm.
Instead of like actually looking for a man you want to marry.
Oh, I see. You want to find
like
an
find
agent.
All your professional partners.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, agent, all yeah. the stuff.
Well, you can go and find those on different sites, right? They have like business related sites like LinkedIn. Things like that.
Yeah, is LinkedIn's... Well, actually, LinkedIn's not BS because a friend of mine got a really good job off LinkedIn.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a recruiter yeah. found him.
I'm just not going to waste my time
Me
with this
either.
Thing. You know,
I'm not either.
I'm spending enough time on Facebook. I don't even have time for Twitter, you know. That one requires
Twitter
a lot of time.
Twitter irritates me. I'm just like, do people need to know? I mean, however, my friend linked it up, where if I put a status update on my Twitter, it goes to my Facebook, so
really?
Then I don't have to do
yeah.
both.
You can do it in reverse as well.
But all my status updates have slowed down. My Twitter's, I mean, everything's slowed down just because that shit takes, sorry guys, that stuff takes so much time.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't take time. I'm
Except
just like,
Facebook. Facebook doesn't really require a lot of time. You know?
It doesn't, but it's so narcissistic.
Nah, I don't know. But with Facebook, it's like you can accumulate more friends quickly because, I mean, some people will beg to differ, but the point is on Twitter, you have to be noticed, you know, and that takes a while. You have to follow other people so they'll see you and notice you. On Facebook, it's not like that. You know, you just ask for a friendship. If they approve, that's it, you know. So people find out about you and you don't have to work hard at it, you know. I mean, Twitter, just when I started, there was a time when I was hoping to really build it in that. And I realized it's just too much time, too much effort. It's not
Oh,
worth
is it.
It? Yeah.
How does it work? You have to follow
it.
People?
You follow people and people follow you, you know, but they have to discover you. So you got to post a lot. You got to make sure you're visible, that you follow other people so they'll notice you. That's the way it is, you know. I don't know why on Facebook it seems a lot easier. So that's why I'm not wasting any time on Twitter. There's not, you know, even when you respond to someone publicly,
uh-huh.
it doesn't look like a response. I mean, it's not like next to the original post.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know what's going on. You can't really communicate with people.
Oh.
That's the way I see it. I don't know.
Well, I think a lot of friends of mine go on Twitter for professional things.
Mm-hmm.
Like if a company is offering a specific, for example, the griddle. In Hollywood, they had red velvet pancakes, and it was like one day.
Uh-huh.
And you have to find them on Twitter to find out what day these pancakes come out.
Oh, really?
The special things like that.
Okay.
The Kogi truck, again, food related. Do you know about the Kogi truck?
No.
Oh, my gosh, so good. It's a Korean and Mexican fusion type food. It's one of those gourmet trucks that goes around town.
Uh-huh.
And they sell like short rib, burritos, all these amazing, really great food.
Yeah.
And you don't know where they're going to be. You have to follow them on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really clever in that way.
Yeah, that's true.
And LA likes the whole exclusive thing. I mean, if you do a comedy show and it's actually underground and there's like, you know, anybody can come to it, but you have to know about it to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to get a better turnout.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird.
Wow.
It's like the exclusive
yeah.
element.
Yeah, I mean, people are more involved in it, I guess.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. It's just more exclusive, I guess.
Yeah.
Hey, when are you going to Israel?
Next month.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah,
I'm thinking about leaving town then when you go.
Good. You should.
Yeah. Can I come?
Go travel. Yeah. I'm actually not that eager to go, you know.
Really?
I'm going more for the family. Yeah.
But I thought that you like Israel.
I do, but for some reason, I'm not in the mood for it right now. I don't know why, but I'm going to make myself go because the family and, you know, I miss them and I think it's the right thing to do.
It is the right thing to do, but still...
No, I'm sure I'll enjoy it once I'm there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just not looking forward to the long flights and you know, and the aggravating things about Israel, you know, there's things that irritate me, like the drivers, the behavior of people on the street, you know. But the nice thing is that there are differences, you know. People are warmer, it seems, you know, than here.
You said before that they're pushier, more aggressive, and yet now they're warmer. How does
right.
that work?
Well, it does, because when you're one-on-one with them, it's a whole different ballgame.
Okay.
Know? When they're in crowds, it's really irritating, you know, like on the roads and that, or like if you try to get on a bus, there's no lines, it's just everybody crowding around the door. So, you know, that makes it difficult, and for me, it's a culture shock, although I'm from there, but, you know, I mean, I've lived most of my life here, and I'm an American, you know, so... I've learned the politeness, the respect, you know, and all these things, but you go there and it's out the window.
Mm.
But there's great things about it, definitely great things about it, you know. So I'll have fun, I'll bring pictures, and it'll be fine. It'll be fine. So where were you thinking of going?
I'll probably go to Texas because it's been about a year.
Nice.
Yeah, it's been about a year. Yeah. And a friend of mine, actually ex-boyfriend, we're still really, really good friends, and he and I were thinking about going to Austin, seeing some friends and things like that. But then I need to see my aunt in Houston, so that's why I have to figure out how long I'd be there.
Yeah.
How long is your thing?
2 weeks.
Oh, well, that's enough time. Shit, that's way too long.
You'll have plenty of time.
That's way too long. Actually, I last time I went, I had a blast because I was there for a month, but I went with a bunch of girlfriends, and we did Texas up.
Really?
Videotaped the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of fun. But what's interesting is this year is my first high school graduation. What's it
Reunion.
Called? Reunion. Reunion, yeah.
Wow.
My 10-year.
Yeah.
So it'll be 10 years out of high school. I graduated year 2000.
Uh-huh.
So isn't that interesting?
It is interesting. Are you going to it?
I don't know. I think it's in September, so that's kind of close to leaving. When is it? June you're going?
June. September's not that close.
No, it's not that close. It's weird because of Facebook.
Yeah.
I've kind of seen a lot of the highlights.
Uh-huh.
I've gotten to see the cool stuff about what people are doing, who has families,
right.
Who's gotten fat, all that good stuff, right?
Yeah.
I don't really care about that. I'm just joking, but not really. but you've kind of gotten to see people that have, not intimately, but from a distance. And so it's like, okay.
Yeah.
And high school just wasn't my thing. I mean, I didn't hate it, but I felt like it was purgatory.
Really? Yeah.
I was one of these kids that once I hit like sophomore, more junior in high school,
mm-hmm.
I was really ready to go after what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I ended up graduating a little bit early, but like just a couple semesters early.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. I wish I would have planned it out and kind of graduated a couple years early, but I didn't
right.
I didn't foresee that. I thought I was going to love high school. Like, high school.
So you're not that into school. I mean, you didn't want to go on to college and things.
I mean, I did go on to college for a year,
right.
But it wasn't for me because I was studying vocal performance.
Right.
I wasn't even studying vocal education. I was studying
right.
performance.
Uh-huh.
And I thought to myself, okay, and I wasn't at a conservatory. I was like, what am I doing here? I either need to be in a conservatory hitting it hard, or I just need to go do it.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the path I came to. And I didn't have the resources to just go to a conservatory, and I didn't really know how to go about doing that.
Right.
I didn't grow up with that kind of, you know, like when kids grow up, I mean, you know this with your kids, it's you educate them, there's a lot of college preparation. There's a lot of getting kids thinking already in that mentality and getting them in a place where they have opportunities and teaching them how to go about stuff. I was really, I didn't have that support.
Mm.
It wasn't like people didn't care, but nobody was really kind of helping me in the college process.
Right,
so I
yeah.
just did that. I just did
so
some,
it was hard for you to focus
well,
on.
Well, I was young, so it was really like I didn't exactly know how to achieve
right.
these goals.
Right.
I mean, because I thought, oh, I want to go to Juilliard, but I had no clue about how to really do it.
I mean,
I knew there was an audition somewhere. I didn't really know how to get prepared. So anyway, I ended up going to just a junior college nearby, studying vocal performance, and I was kind of like, what am I doing here? This like none of it made sense with my dreams.
Right.
I mean, that's not for everybody. Some people need to do college, but I was sitting there and I was like, this just none of it fit.
Not for you, huh?
Mm-mm. It was a year in. I mean, I would definitely go back to school once my career is established just to learn because I think that's great. But
that's fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Going to college is a lot of fun, you know. I mean, I went back at a later age and graduated with honors, you know.
Oh, cool.
But I think when you go there a little more mature,
you're in a place to really absorb
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right after high school, you know, that I think the odds are against you that you'll do well, you know, because you're still, like, stuck in that state of mind of social life and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, you mean do well or do bad?
Where in college, I think you do much better if you're mature and you wait a few years.
I actually agree. Now, what's a deterrent with that is that people have said, oh, well, if you wait, you won't go.
No, that's not true.
And I went back
at 26, 27.
Well, that's what I've really learned out here in L.A. It's a very West Coast. I had a lot of friends that were starting their undergrad at, like, you know, 25, 26
right.
years old.
Yeah.
And they're just now taking their freshman courses.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay. Because everybody's just very individualistic. And I think where I was from in Texas, it was very much, this is how things are done. This is how you do it. This is the age. If you've passed the age, then it's kind of
right.
embarrassing or something.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up dropping out or finishing, or not finishing, just dropping out my 1 year and pretty much moved out here.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. I was like, what am I going to do?
You should start taking some classes at Santa Monica College or something. You know?
No, I don't need to take classes.
No, you don't need
I'm actually doing what I want to do, and I'm taking it to a different level. What
but
I want to do.
You want to learn, right?
No, I read books every day. I've got a great book in my bag right now.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you reading?
It's called Sex God. I told you about it.
Sex God?
Yeah, here.
Sex God. What would that be about, I'm wondering?
You're not going to like it, but...
Yeah, you with a book, titled Sex, I'm amazed.
It says, exploring the endless connections between sexuality and spirituality.
Mm.
And it's really quite fascinating, and it talks about how... It's by Rob Bell, and the book really talks about how sex, S-E-X, is derived from the Latin root word sect, mm-hmm. S-E-C-T, which you get section, dissect, bisect. And that sex is really more than the act. It's really about connection.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how we say we're sexual beings, we're made
right.
sexual? Well, it's very, very true because sex is kind of the deep, deep part of our essence, the intimate, intimate part of who we are.
Uh-huh.
And so beyond the act of sex and you look at sexuality, it's really about connection. And people can be having a lot of sex, right, and not be sexy or not really be connecting. People can be celibate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not advocating celibacy, so don't stress. But you can actually find people that are celibate,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of stores up passion. It almost people can sometimes be more sexy,
mm-hmm.
and that it's just about connection and being present and being in tune. And they also talk about they use an example of you can go to like a corporate event, like a concert, where there's all these people around and everybody's sharing in the same experience, and it's a very sexual experience because everyone's connected to this music and
mm-hmm.
everybody's being moved to the music, and there's a real deep, deep connectedness. And that
right.
that's it's how God made us, that there's the sex is part of how God made us. It's like mm-hmm. our core.
Right.
You know, partly connected to our soul, just the connection. And it goes through obviously it uses the act of sex, but it goes into environment, relationships, political, and,
mm-hmm.
and it's really fascinating because it takes sex to a different level.
Right.
Yeah.
Which suits you just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not just fine. I mean, it's still challenging. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting read. Yeah. It really is. I mean, he goes down so many different paths with it that are, I think are very true,
mm-hmm.
but they're beyond the act of sex, you know?
Right.
It's really more, deeper than that. But one of the interesting things he talks about is how sex that has been taken out of its context in a way can be very dehumanizing. And he talks about the concentration camps.
Uh-huh.
And that they were designed to break people down.
Right.
And yeah, exactly. Just right. break people down. And people were dehumanized. They were
right.
just completely humiliated and degraded and treated worse than animals. And one thing that this is pretty fascinating, the Red Cross that showed up once they were freeing some of the concentration camps, they brought this insightful to think this, they brought tubes of lipstick.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know this?
No.
They brought tubes of lipstick, and as they're binding wounds and feeding people, and some people are still dying because you couldn't save everybody. I mean, there's
right.
so many people that are just even in the process of dying. People had these lifeless bodies just would have like lipstick on their lips.
Yeah.
And it was about giving them some kind of identity,
mm.
giving them some kind of something frivolous.
Make them feel human again, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like something frivolous to make them feel human.
Yeah.
Make them feel, and I just thought that was so fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine 6 million people systematically killed? It's like beyond anything
yeah.
that you can even imagine.
I don't think we can even understand it now. I mean, I always wonder, how did this one guy convince nations
mm-hmm.
that a people were like a monster and a problem? And
right.
and I think that
you see, it was easy because these feelings and these sentiments always were there against
uh-huh.
Jews. So all he had to do was awaken them again, you know?
Now, wasn't he Jewish himself? Like
nah, come on.
He wasn't he had like part Jew?
No.
He looked Jew.
He looked Jewish?
Yeah.
Come on. What are you talking about?
You know, but it's interesting though, is Hitler, you know, just, and like a mad genius, right? Is what they call him. And I was told that the public wasn't as aware of what was going on in the concentration camps.
Yeah, some were not. But for the most part, I think a lot of people did know, you know. And that's beside the point. I mean, the thing is that they created a machine to kill people,
yeah.
you know. I mean, it's just a well-oiled machine, a military that could just decimate a whole people. You know, and they almost succeeded too. And sure enough, you know, that's why I say the United States is very important to the world.
I agree. I had this conversation yesterday, but go on.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I say the world needs a cop, you know, and we're more qualified than anybody else. I really think so.
Oh, yeah. That's funny.
What?
No, just because it's just funny, because it just sounds so like American Rambo. I'm coming to a country near you.
Not necessarily that way,
we're gonna,
you know.
Whoop
but,
your ass.
Yeah. No. But without the Americans, I mean, who knows?
Well, I mean, the only reason I go down this path, not the only reason, but one of the reasons I have this conversation with people is because there's such a, it's very chic to be anti-American in as an American right now, like in our in our country. It's very kind of like, I'm against the man kind of attitude to be against the U.S.
Right.
And being a pacifist or saying, I hate war. Well, who likes war? It's disgusting. It's awful. It's not fair. It's not good. It's awful. People that want to defend a country, it doesn't mean they believe in war. It doesn't mean they like war, but they're saying it's necessary to defend their people. And I find that so aggravating because it's a luxury to sit back and drink your latte and smoke your fucking cigarette, and sit there at being so brilliant at your coffee shop. And you know what? You haven't fought for any of those rights. You've lived off the fat of a land. You've lived off the freedom that was just given to you. You sit there so entitled, and then you have no gratitude. And that bothers me. It bothers me because it's so rampant in this city.
Yeah.
It's so rampant.
But it's because it's an individualistic society, you know?
Yeah, but it's also like, you know what?
Give me,
you know what? You know, have somebody throw you into a freaking concentration camp or, you know, have somebody take away your rights and then we'll see what kind of attitude you have.
Right.
You know,
it bothers me.
Well, it's
all relative, you know? It is relative. But, I mean, we don't want to get to the point where we're just grateful
to
be alive.
No, that's my point. That's exactly my point is I just think that there's this, we're so far removed from what it means to be grateful for what we have in this country that people are just, I think, so flippant and disrespectful to the people that have worked so hard to give us what we have. And, you know, it's a luxury to sit out there and be like, no war, no war. It's like, okay, like nobody wants war. Who wants war?
Right. Well, we had that big discussion with your friend here the other day. Remember that?
Yeah. But it just, I understand, like, it's like I was just talking to Sarah, my roommate. She went back to Canada and she's been going to this, well, she goes to this church there. It's a really cool church, but part of the way the guy, he has a sermon that he teaches that part is about being a pacifist, basically, and that Jesus Christ was a pacifist. So they kind of take that model and they kind of think that that should be the way a country should operate when it comes to violence and things like that.
Right.
And I think it's taking apples and oranges, personally, and I think it's not taking the whole Bible, but whatever, that's a longer discussion. But what I have to say is, you know, there, if you walked into a room and a child was being raped in front of you and you did nothing, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You're an accomplice by law, right?
There you go.
Right.
And I mean, I don't really know if it's our job to police the world. I'm not saying that. But when, you know, when a lot of security is at risk and you know, there's a, I mean, even just our borders and issues like that, we have a responsibility. There's a responsibility to protect a nation.
Exactly.
That's the
one.
That's before,
think, you know?
Like the basic root of you know, any part of government is number one essential one is to protect your country. And if you just let everybody just pillage at your country, well, you're not doing your job.
Yeah, but some people claim that certain things that we do are not to protect our country.
And that's up for debate. And I understand having those kind of arguments. But having the argument that you should never protect your country because that's just being a bad guy, well, then that I think is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're debating on is this protection or is this self-interest, that's a different conversation. But but what I'm talking about is people arguing that we should never, you know, ever use force. We should never defend or protect. We should never, you know, go after
that.
Yeah,
that's bullshit. You know, I mean, there's always going to be war, and sometimes you fight it for good reasons, you know, and to save other people. And I can tell you that when we dropped the bomb on Japan, you know, we saved millions of lives because it could have ended up differently if we hadn't, you know. So, according to their calculations, they figured, yeah, some people are going to die, but it's going to save a lot more people if the war kept going. So, you know, you never know. I mean, I'm not saying it was necessarily the only option, but, you know, the thing is with when you have countries like North Korea and Iran, you have to be careful. You know, you have to watch them. Somebody has to. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody's more qualified than us to do that. So, you know, that's what's going on. There, I think Noel is calling, so let's go ahead. Good morning. Is this Noel?
Hello, Sam. How are you?
Good, good. You're so punctual every time. I really appreciate that, you know. 9:30 on the dot and you're here.
Love it.
So you're calling us from Arkansas this morning, right?
I am actually calling you from New York City.
Oh, really? What are you
New
doing
York
in New York these days?
Well, I'm doing Hannity on Fox News tonight, actually.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. I got to actually meet him. When I went up there for the new media seminars they had for talk radio, and he was there, and he threw a dinner for everyone. So he's a very nice man. Have you been on his show before?
I've been on. I'm on probably about 3 times a month, and we're doing a special segment on the oil spill and the Obama administration's handling of it.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's going on? How are they handling it? Well, you know, I mean, all I'm seeing is more and more damage, but I don't see anything from the government being done.
Well, you know, and that's the argument. The argument is they're trying not, you know, when they came out, they never had a plan. The only thing, if you can remember, and everyone will be able to recall this, is they came on and on and on saying this is BP's problem. We all know that. We all get it, but BP, and this has been a month after the spill,
right,
is still not handling it well. There needs to be a plan B, and the federal government, the Obama administration, is still concerned about political correctness, and if they get in the middle of it, if they have a plan B and they take it over and it doesn't work, it's going to be considered on their hands, and I think they're more concerned with political correctness of it than getting it right. I mean,
Isn't it already
going to take the help of federal government and BP.
Isn't it already considered a little bit on their hands? I've heard people say that this is like his Katrina issue.
You're exactly right. That's what they're saying, and that's what the White House is trying to avoid, is being labeled with this. But, I mean, you've got to realize, I mean, look at the numbers here. 22,000 people are involved in the cleanup, 1,000 vessels. It's costing BP $22 million a day.
A day.
This is a day. I mean, can BP afford it?
Right.
Help me out with this, Noel. I saw a little bit on it how there was one system in place, but there wasn't any they had a pretty appropriate system, but it just wasn't even available, which was, what is it called, they're fire starters or something. They're these barrels that are out, basically they're fire that burns it off,
right?
And they should be they should be available, and they're supposed to be within a certain amount of them out there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, whatever. But they weren't there. And
right.
It would have been simple just to have them there, and it would have cleaned it up right away.
Right.
Or, you know, lessened the damage, but that wasn't in place. Do you know anything about that as far as those systems not being in place and why they weren't?
That's part of the problem. And I'm very glad that you brought that up. You're very informed on that. And, yeah, if they were in place, I don't know if it would have stopped it, because they didn't estimate, you know, how much would be coming out. You know, the numbers have been kind of screwy. But as far as if they would have had that into place, that would have probably stopped, you know, the severity of it at least. You know what I mean?
Right.
And they didn't have it in place.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I know they've been trying different methods to stop this, but obviously they haven't been successful with any of them yet. And you would think they'd be prepared for something like this.
Well, you know, I don't think, first of all, they shouldn't have been drilling that far down. So, you know, that's why they're to blame. So, you know, of course, you know, look how this is at the center of the earth. I mean, there's no ending of this, you know.
Wait a minute,
and
I didn't hear this. What did you say, Noel? They went further down than they were allowed or supposed to do, or what happened with that?
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, you have certain regulations for, you know, how far you can drill and what you can do. I mean, everybody has regulations, and they exceeded it. You know, they went where they weren't supposed to.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, they're saying that they caused it. It's their fault. They didn't just make a mistake. They went a little too far. So, I mean, this is all on their hands. And like I said, We all know BP is to blame. But the deal is, we have a disaster, and the government needs to step in and go, hey, you guys are not doing this. Instead of going with the BP plan, it ain't working. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not working.
Yeah.
And so you're saying the administration is not really coming up with solutions at this point?
What they're doing is, right now in the New York Times and in USA Today, they are stating that they are really going to be pushing BP to really get a cap on this, as if BP is taking their time and not wanting to do it. I mean, this is costing them $22 million a day.
Wow.
You know, take in mind, they have a monthly cash flow of $3 billion. Cash on hand BP has is $6 billion, and they have a credit line of $15 billion. So their only access is to $24 billion max. This thing's costing $22 plus a day. So by putting pressure on BP to get it right, they want to get it right.
Right.
Somebody, we need to work together on this, no matter whose fault it is. And, Bobby Jindal.
It's everybody's problem.
Yeah. And they're the ones that caused the problem in the first place. I don't know why we'd go to them to try and fix it, So
Sam, that is the smartest thing you just said. That is so funny. They caused it in the first place, and we're looking to them to have the master plan on fixing it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So that you think the biggest apprehension for them to get involved is that they're not confident that they have a solution, and if they fail, it'll be another strike against the administration?
I think that's exactly right. I think they feel like if they take the reins and tell BP, hey, we're not going to work with you, you're going to work with us, then it's on, it's on their watch. You know, when you've got James Carville, who's from Louisiana, everybody knows him as a number one big guru Democratic strategist, he's criticizing the administration by saying, hey, it's not working, you have to have a plan B.
Right.
Government doesn't have a plan.
Yeah,
they don't want to get involved.
Wow.
Because it's going to look the 2010 elections, 2012 coming up, and I bet by 2012, this thing is still not cleaned up. I mean, think it's going to take 30 days and it's cleaned up? This is all over the place.
Right.
What kind of damage are we looking at? I mean, as far as you're talking about, it's already been going on, a month, you said?
Been going on a month, and it's still not capped.
Yeah,
so, who knows? I mean, that's the scary part. But look what it's doing. I mean, it's killing the environment.
Right.
It's killing people's jobs, their companies. And did you know Louisiana, the coastline, is the number one fishing place in the United States, which I didn't know until today.
Really? So
most of our fish comes from there.
Really? So this spill totally screwed up all the environment there, the entire.
Yeah, because a lot of the fish and the shrimp and different things feed off the things that are around in the Gulf, and when you're killing it and it can't even grow back and it's getting into the wetlands. Well, what are you going to do to replace, what do you do?
Right.
So there's all kinds of things in play here.
Right. So people should know that despite the fact that it's not close to us as far as, let's say, being in California, it is going to be devastating, and there's going to be implications for years to come for just about everyone.
I want
to ask. Well, Sam, when you guys go to a restaurant, what's it going to look like when you order the shrimp dish for, $10,000 a plate? because it's going to affect it sooner or later.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Noelle, as far as drilling, okay, there's just so much. I was an advocate for more offshore drilling while we're still looking for alternative solutions. This is definitely hurting that.
Unfortunately, this is hurting the movement of drill, baby, drill. But,
this is so awful. So my question is for people that are, we all care about the environment, but how long has it been prior to this that they had the last spill?
The Exxon Valdez.
The Exxon Valdez.
Right.
And how many years ago?
Bad in effect.
Right. That was probably, 15, 20 years ago?
So is it too big of a casualty to move forward in this department where you're going, it's only 20 years between each spill? or whatever, you know, but still, it's just that the magnitude is so devastating. Right. I mean, I wonder if that's going to be the argument. I don't know, because I don't really know the severity and the long reaching effects to the totality of what they do. But
I think, like, it wasn't it in 89 that it was like something like 11 million gallons Exxon Valdez oil spill head, which right. was off Alaska.
Right, right. And that was devastating. I mean, there's still, like, I think there's still, like, leftover problems from that. And that was 20 years
ago.
There are. Yeah.
There are, and I mean, you know, everything is a risk. So, I mean, you can't drill for oil without a risk.
Right.
But here's the deal. They shouldn't have been drilling there anyway. They shouldn't have been drilling in that depth anyway. So they made a conscious, if you want to know the truth, they made a conscious mistake. I mean, they drilled too far,
right.
you know?
Right. Wow. So, I mean, do you think that this is going to bankrupt them, you know, after everything is said and done? Do you think BP is...
Well, I mean, you've got to realize this. Not only is it costing $22 million a day, that's an average. And you know how everybody is with numbers. I'm sure it's more. But, I mean, think about the personal lawsuits. Just think, trial lawyers are gearing up already. People that are going to be losing all their businesses because of the oil spill, all their tourism, the hotels and the coast. I mean, think about it.
Right.
And they're all, and the government is standing up and saying it's BP's fault, and BP's like, okay. So
yeah.
Think about it. Now, their insurance, you know, I'd like to know who insures BP, because they're probably going to go belly up with the claims.
Right. Right.
Wow, that's just so intense, man.
Yeah.
Let me, going on to a little bit of a different topic, I'm just curious as to where we are with this. Noelle, have you been keeping up with the stock market? How are we doing?
I cannot believe the up and down of the market. And I think that you can, you know, people are fearful. I think Spain is in trouble today.
Right.
And of course our market reacts to it. And, you know, before that and ongoing is Greece's turmoil.
Yes,
so I think that everything is connected now. We're all global. You can't look abroad and watch what's happening in the financial world overseas and think it's not affecting us. We're all interlocked now, especially with China holding so much of our paper.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. And the euro is in trouble, although for Americans it's a good opportunity to go to Europe, because everything's going to be pretty inexpensive. And I remember when I went to Europe and the dollar was weak and the prices were outrageous, you know. So, I mean, if there's anything good coming out of this. But you're right. I mean, it's a problem for the entire European Union, and it's going to affect us and the Asian markets as well. And, so definitely there's, and I think they are doing something about it, though. And they're injecting money into these countries that are in trouble.
But I think correct me if I'm wrong or way off. I mean, I've been told that that's what you get with a socialist society. You know, you get a society that can't sustain itself, and then it's been hiding and hiding and hiding its issues, and then the EU doesn't want to bail out or didn't want to bail out Greece, right?
No, they did. They did.
No.
They did, but they didn't.
But
they didn't want to. Right?
Right. Right.
They didn't want to. And I guess going back to, you know, when we plummeted that significant day when everything dropped. What was it, like 900,000 points or something like that? What was it like
900? Yeah.
900 points, and then they didn't quickly regain to 2/3 of where it was, and then I don't know where it is now. I haven't kept up with it.
Yeah. But,
right, it did. But all of it's affected, you know, by the things that are going on every day, and people are skittish anyway. I mean, look at what's going on. This is insane. And the disasters and the money exchanging hand to help, just like the Haitian,
right.
when they had that disaster and all the monies that went towards that. I mean, think about everything that's going on anyway. And Sammy brought up a kind of a good point as far as the dollar versus the euro. It is a good time to visit. I mean, you know, I can remember going to Europe not too long ago, where the only restaurant I could go to would be McDonald's, and that
right.
was still, you know, $15.
Yeah.
Oh, really? That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is. When it gets, when the euro gets strong, it gets very expensive there.
Have you guys heard about the Amero?
The Amero
about bringing together,
The dollar and the euro?
The North American Union trying to make Canada and the U.S. and Mexico all one currency, the Amira.
I think
if they did anything like that, I think Obama, I think that entire administration would need to pack their bags and move to Canada, because I think one more inch towards socialism and people would view that as socialism, intertwining anything with Canada. I think that they have a buzz outside the White House.
I don't think it's like a tomorrow thing. I don't think it's like a tomorrow thing. I think it's something that they've been kind of leaning towards for a while, and that it'll be a while before it gets there, but it's kind of the road signs are leading there.
Yeah.
That kind of situation, and trying to, and you know about the, not the, is it the pipeline or the, not the pipeline, but the, they're trying to build that system from Mexico all the way to Canada, basically.
Mm. For oil or water?
I think it's like I can't exactly remember if it's like a freeway or... Have you guys not heard about this?
No, I haven't heard
about
it.
Well, I'll have to look
it
up.
Yeah.
Well, don't take my word on it.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to have nightmares. Thank you.
No, no, no.
What do you think? It's a tunnel from Mexico to Canada.
No. Not a tunnel. It's basically just the moving towards... But you know what? This is one of those long time coming type things where it's not overnight. But something to look into. Not that I have all the facts clearly, but just something that I've read.
Definitely something to look into, not forward to.
Yeah.
No, it's just to look into. And I was driving down, where was it, La Cienega the other day, and going towards the airport, and they had impeach Obama signs.
Really?
And I thought, wow, you're brave.
Yeah.
You know?
Actually, considering where they put them, that is pretty brave.
In L.A., I was like, wow, you are brave people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and finally, you know, we talk about L.A. and stuff, and today there are demonstrations about the boycott of California of Arizona.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
Wow. Yeah, you know, I did. I did hear about that. What is actually going on? What is the basis of that?
It's the city of Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, it's just that. And we have Hispanics here in government, and I think that's what it is, you know, because they say they look at that law as though it's aimed at Hispanics and Mexicans, and they're trying to punish Arizona for that, you know. But people are not happy about it at all. And
how can they legally enforce what businesses can do business with? I mean, city of Los Angeles, or
you can't.
That's what I thought. You can't do that. Right.
I mean, you can't legally enforce. I mean, it seems like that's violations all over the place. And not only that, I mean, did you hear where they're cracking down by actually coming down and looking at teachers with thick Hispanic accents?
Really?
I mean, they're
doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's reaching a whole new ball game. I mean, let's face it. I mean, illegal immigration is a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Major problem too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a major problem, and you know, these people are not paying taxes, and it's hurting everyone else. I mean, they're burdening the emergency rooms, the healthcare, and what about, there's a gray area of children that are born to illegal immigrants,
right,
that are in the U.S. illegally.
Right.
I mean, what happens to that? That's such a gray area.
Yeah, and but I know as of now, they're American citizens when they're born here, right?
Yes, that's right.
Then
so what do you do?
Parents,
I mean.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I definitely hear you. Now, going back to the, you know, questioning people with thick Hispanic accents, I think that's a violation. I mean, that just, to me, is just way too...
I think they're going far.
Yeah.
I think they're reaching way too far.
See,
I
thought they were lightening up because they were getting so much flack. I didn't realize that they were going down that department.
Yeah,
it's just one of the other avenues that they're in order to crack down on who's here illegally, that they're going to check into, which, you know, I actually think that's drawing the line. I think that's absurd.
Right, yeah.
I didn't realize they were doing that. I thought it was just if you're caught in the act of crime.
Right.
They have
right.
The right.
But,
they
I mean, these
right.
are new. These are proposed things that they're looking at, which I just think are crazy.
That's right. Disgusting. That's disgusting. That's not the kind of country we live in. You know what I mean? That's not,
not at all.
No, that's disgusting. I mean, I can understand if you're caught in an act of crime, you know, like you're speeding or you're caught in something, that they have the right to go, okay, are you a U.S. citizen, you know? To me, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think they're going to be careful with profiling and stuff.
Well,
you know?
I thought they would be too.
Because the whole world is looking at them.
Considering what she just said, it sounds like they're not. It sounds like they're freaking having a heyday.
Yeah.
I'm gonna
taking it a little too far.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, we're talking to Noel Nikpor, of course. The website is noel-nikpor. That's N-I-K-P-O-U-R.com. And Noel is a Republican consultant and strategist, and always having great things to say. Noel, thank you so much. And so you're going to be on Hannity tonight?
I'm going to be on Hannity tonight, and I'm going to be up against Bob Beckel. So it'll be a very interesting discussion on the oil spill and how Obama is handling it. So Watch it tonight.
Wonderful. And you're going to be there in person, right? So we're going to get to see you.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
What time? Yeah, Sam's excited about that.
Well, Noel is...
Oh, you guys.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you. I mean, you used to do modeling and stuff. Do you still do that?
Yeah, I do. I've done swimsuit modeling, fitness modeling, mainly like, let's just say a gym is opening up or a chain of gyms and they'll need someone for the brochure or whatever. I've always incorporated physical fitness for years in my routine, and I think it's very important.
Wonderful. Well, everybody, watch Noel tonight on Hannity. Noel, thank you so much. You're always very interesting.
Thank you very much,
a lot of
Noel.
Fun. And we appreciate that. So enjoy yourself tonight at the at Fox.
All right. Thank you, guys, and have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care. So, that's Noelle for you. And I love talking to her. You know, she's very bright, and she knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, she's a cool woman. I like her.
Yeah. And, so we're going to take a little break. We'll be back right after this.
For the most entertaining talk anywhere, stay tuned to LA Talk Radio. Your real talk station. Your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
computer, on your Wi-Fi radio, on your iPhone. Commercial-free original talk, only on LA Talk Radio, your favorite talk station.
The phone lines are open on Sam and Kara in the morning. Pick up your phone and jump in on the conversation. Dial 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815 and get in on the fun. Now, let's get back to Sam and Kara in the morning on LA Talk Radio.
Okay, and we're back, and we have our guest in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Oh, I just stopped it abruptly there. It's not like me. And
you gotta work on those musical and producing skills.
So we have Patty Johnson in the studio.
Patty Johnson!
And you're a clinical psychologist, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, that means I specialize in behavioral mental health issues of the patient population.
Yeah. Uh-huh. How long have you been doing that?
10 years.
10 years. Mm-hmm. Now, to be a clinical psychologist, I mean, you're not just a therapist, right? You're licensed and everything?
To be a psychologist, you have to have a doctorate degree in clinical psychology.
Oh, I see.
You have a psychologist,
okay. Yes. But you can't dispense medication, right? You
no.
have to be a psychiatrist.
A psychiatrist is an
right.
MD, yeah.
Wonderful. And so you said you're not originally from here, right?
No, I'm not.
Where are you originally from?
Well, I was born in Oregon. And
oh, really?
I was a military brat. My father is a retired 2-star general.
Really? So you moved around a lot?
I moved around a lot.
Really?
10 schools between kindergarten and senior.
Oh, my God.
Different states, countries.
Yeah. That's hard to plant any roots, huh?
Yeah, you plant emotional roots.
Yeah, I guess.
Take those with you.
Yeah. Has that caused problems for you growing up?
Not really. I think it made me very resilient and very adaptable to new situations.
And independent
And
stuff,
independent,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens with friends? I mean, it's hard to make friends and then leave, you know? I know that I moved a lot quite a bit and with my parents. Mm-hmm. And I know it was hard every time that you have to leave, you know, and you made all these friends and everything. And I would imagine, you know, people going through that would maybe have commitment issues or attachment issues or something, you know? What do you think?
Well, I think it's possible. You probably can go one or two ways. You can use it for coping and resiliency, or you can use it on a collapsing sort of continuum.
That's
true. Yeah.
But on the other hand, in a military community, everybody is doing that. So everybody's kind of used to welcoming the new girl and saying goodbye to people. So it's kind of like it's your norm, and it's the norm of people around you.
Right, yeah. And do you have any siblings?
Yes, a brother and a sister.
I see. So you all moved around.
Right. We all moved around together. So you always had a little bit of a support team.
Yeah.
We did that. I was not in the military, but a lot of the dads my mom married, they were. So, you know, instability, which is normal.
Yeah.
But as a kid, it didn't feel right.
Yeah.
I think as a kid, it doesn't feel right. I mean, in your adult life, you look back and you look at what you've learned and how it's really shaped your character. Like you said, resilience, which I think is so key. But I think as a kid, it still feels weird, you know?
I think it does, because you're always the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, I'm doing it again in L.A. I'm the new kid on the block again. You're
but
all starting over.
Yeah, but I think what you said is really awesome, though, as far as resilience and just really being able to adapt. And I meet so many people, maybe in L.A. too, but I think more so in other parts of the world or the country, where people moving is just the biggest thing in the world. Starting over is so big,
right.
Meaning like it's almost like so big they probably won't ever do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's so interesting, you know what I mean? Whereas if you, like yourself, you've traveled so much, you've lived so many different lives, I'm sure that it's like, you know, it's in your second nature to be able to kind of just take on a new adventure.
Right.
For some people, I told them I moved to L.A., they're like, I can't believe you did that. And then some people in Texas were like, well, one day I want to move to Austin. I'm like, hey, that's in the same state. Why don't you just get on that? I'm just not ready yet. I'm not ready. I'm like, when are you ever going to be ready? You know what I mean? It's true. Yeah, it's really true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
So what were some of your favorite places that you live?
Well, I really love living in just a few miles from D.C. I mean,
oh, really?
That's the longest place I've ever lived, next to Germany.
Uh-huh.
It's the longest place. I just love the, you know, being in the kind of political arena and the culture. And, you know, D.C. was always there. It's always something to do.
Right.
I've noticed a difference that you always can go into the city. And it feels like here there's not a city to go into.
Right.
Everything's in one place.
Everything is the city.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything is. There's lots of different places. I think that your city is your car.
Right. There
I know. It's really, that is actually true.
You learn fast.
Huh? Yeah, I'm learning the 405 and the 101.
Yeah.
So when did you move here from D.C.?
I moved here here in August of last year.
Oh, I see. So mm-hmm. you're pretty new here. Mm-hmm. And what made you decide to move to L.A., of all places?
Well, it's funny because I was in Las Vegas where I met my husband. And he's from California.
Really?
So we dated long distance for a while. Then I ended up making the move out here.
Really?
Uh-huh.
How long were you doing the long distance thing?
About a year and a half.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's a long time.
It
huh?
was.
That's
yeah.
a long ass time.
Yeah. Bi-coastal.
Oh my gosh. I mean, so you guys met in Vegas, what, like at a craps table? How did that work? I mean, I want to hear this story. This is exciting.
I was actually there with a friend for a conference.
Uh-huh.
She was doing an accessory show. She's into that. And he was there visiting his brother. And we just happened to be actually in a restaurant. And it was kind of crowded. The only table, I said, could we sit here? And end up sitting down next to them.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Wow. See, that's
talking.
Something that Kara would do, you know? Mm-hmm. So
he thinks, I'm a raging extrovert, but still. You know, I'm like, hey, guys, tell me your life story. I got 5 minutes. Call me. Let's hang out. Yeah,
yeah. She'll sit next to just about anybody, right?
Because it's an adventure, right?
It is.
People are adventures.
Yeah.
You just start talking. You know, you start talking, and if something, you know, you're not planning anything, mm-hmm. you just start talking. And the next thing you know, I want to talk to this person again. And mm-hmm. I'll call them or we'll talk again. And
yeah.
And next thing you know, you're in a relationship. You're talking every day. So
yeah.
It just sort of happened.
Yeah, I was in a long distance relationship too, and I found it to be very difficult, you know, because I mean, you know, sometimes you just want someone next to you, you know, mm-hmm. you want someone to hug, you want to go out, and you can't do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what it boils down to is just the words, you know, that you talk on the phone. And I think when you only have that, sometimes you get into trouble because, you know, you're talking all the time. That's about all you can do. There's no that intimacy of like just sitting with someone and being quiet, you know, and enjoying their company,
mm-hmm.
you know. So did you find that to be the case?
Well, we managed to create a good emotional intimacy mm-hmm. and being able to really talk about things on phone in ways that we may not have been if we were together. We would have been actively doing things and going places or distracted or watching TV.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we talked a lot in our car on mm-hmm. our Bluetooth. And,
yeah.
you know, we did a lot of things of communicating and getting to know each other that way.
Wow.
And maybe because I'm a therapist, I'm a good listener.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go.
Yeah. You know how to get out the real issues.
Don't
yeah,
talk
I always
much.
Say nobody ever listened themselves out of a relationship.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
At
huh?
this point, I've never had anybody break up, and I say, what happened? He just listened too much. I couldn't take it. Every time I talk, he listened. It
yeah,
drove me crazy.
Funny.
Have you?
That's a good way to look at
that's
it.
That's actually yeah. a really great point.
It's a great point, you know?
Yeah.
You got to develop that skill of listening, and it's a very hard to do.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do.
Yeah.
So you guys were doing the phone thing back and forth. I'm assuming you guys would fly to visit each other. How frequent were the visits?
Well, every other weekend.
Oh, okay. Well, that's manageable.
That's manageable.
Other than financially, it probably was a little bit of a drain, but,
yeah,
you know.
It was, but it was manageable, and it was fun, you know.
I see. So every other week, that's not bad at all.
No.
Yeah.
So we, one weekend on, one weekend off, and both
uh-huh.
busy. And
yeah. And then you decided finally enough. You had enough of that, and you want to be together.
Did he propose, mm-hmm. and then you moved, or what? What
how, yeah.
Okay, that's
yeah.
the way it should go down. That's good.
And I didn't
yeah.
move to propose, married, and then moved. And then we still had about 6 months apart, because I have a private practice there, and I had
uh-huh.
and a business, so
uh-huh.
and a house, and
so
shut
it
things down.
Is it still going on over there, your private practice? Or
mm-hmm.
you, okay,
yeah, I'm
cool.
actually flying out Thursday morning for a week.
Oh, okay, cool.
Really? So you work on both coasts now?
I have been, yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if I had to get on planes that often, I would go crazy, you know? I mean, going through all the security and everything, it's not fun flying anymore.
It's not fun flying. It's that first hour just getting through security. But then you have 5 hours where you have uninterrupted me time.
Right.
Oh,
you
there
know?
You go.
And
yeah.
you can read and your phone's not ringing and
yeah.
you can shut out the world. And I like that part.
Yeah, unless it's a bumpy
there
flight.
There
you
go.
You
that's
know?
A good point.
We came back from New York and the whole 5 hours was just bumpy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I need to get off this plane somehow.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm psychotically optimistic.
Yeah.
So I basically can find something good out about anything.
Yeah. That's good.
Psychotically, I love that.
Psychotically optimistic.
That's
yeah.
hysterical. So you guys are, how long have you been married now?
A year and about 5 months.
So how has the first year been? Has it been, like they say, like newlyweds, they say, don't they say it's like it's bliss, but it's actually one of the hardest years? Is that true or no?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at anything from a psychological perspective, including marriage,
mm-hmm.
there's always a cycle, change, loss, grief. Whenever you have change, you have loss. When you have loss, you have grief.
Mm.
Right.
And you lose all the sense of belongingness, your work, your gym, your friends, what you did every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sense of belongingness to come to the only belongingness you feel is with that one person.
Mm-hmm.
And that can put a lot of pressure on that one person
mm-hmm.
to meet all your needs. So recognizing that and being sort of equipped, because I deal with emotional management. That's kind of my specialty. How do you manage unwanted emotions? But I did realize there is a sense of loss. And you have to learn how to manage that feeling, even if it's a positive thing.
Right.
You've had a lot. I had a lot of losses.
Yeah. That it, 'cause a sacrifice you made for something greater that you want, but you still had to make a sacrifice nonetheless.
Yeah. You can always work, but you can't always find love.
Yeah.
And then once you find love, you have to kind of have a sense of how to take care of it and even manage it and work in it to make it last and make it good.
Well, does he know how awesome you are? Does he get it?
I try to remind him.
Yeah.
Because he forgets.
Well, because I think what happens is a lot of people don't have the tools that you have.
Yeah.
So when they just become, I mean, which doesn't mean they can't get through anything, but it's such an advantage to be able to kind of identify, like what you said, emotional changes and know how to kind of assess it and, you know, work through stuff. So I feel like you're coming really geared up. I mean, if you married a psychologist, how much, you know, like at least they can think, we can work through this. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's pretty cool to have those resources.
Yeah.
You know, get in an argument and then sit him down and be like, how did he feel about that? How did that make you feel? And then just, you know, he's kind of getting free therapy.
Yeah,
and then,
you just want to slap the person.
Yeah, but you know, when you talk to men, you know, you have to recognize that they're more easily emotionally flooded, and so if you have a flood of words or a flood of affect, men are more easily flooded by that. It just kind of triggers parts of their brain and it causes them to kind of shut down.
Oh, really?
Wow, that makes so much sense, though, huh? That's just not their language, right?
Right. And do you find that when you, like, in an argument with the guy, do you find that he shuts down? He's ready to quit before you are?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't realize that I mean, you're giving words to things I've felt that I've picked up on. I've, certain people in my life, I've learned to kind of really let things out slower with them, certain men, and not really realizing that that's what I was doing because I didn't quite put the words to it. But that's so true because there is, I think they're intimidated emotionally and they don't know how to process it as quickly or as women do, right? Women are just like, we're freaking firecrackers, you know, and it's normal to us. I mean, and I've got a lot of really close girlfriends. I mean, we can log some hours talking and we love it. We love to connect that way.
Right.
And I know I'm pretty good about drawing people out and getting guys to open up and we have good conversations, but men, that's just not their aptitude, right? They want to do things with guys. They want to
do more. Women tend to be ruminators. We tend to ruminate. And I know you probably can speak to this. We think about things. Well, why did he say that? And I should have said this. And then this is what I'm going to say. And this is what happened. And we're done with that. Then we call a friend and we ruminate with her.
Then we're done with that.
We call another friend and we ruminate some more with her. Guys like, do you want to go get a drink? You want to play golf? You want to go out? You want to do something?
Right.
You don't hear guys like, oh, what is this? And then they call their friend, I have to talk about this. And then call another friend, I need to talk a little bit more about that. Do you do that, Sam?
No, it doesn't happen.
No. You'll get a guy, you go out. You there's just different ways of regulating your affect.
Right.
You know, when you feel emotionally aroused, you want to calm down.
Mm.
Unless you're an anger addict or, you know, emotional addict.
You say that it's appropriate? Because I feel like, you know, I believe God made both male and female. So there's strengths and weaknesses that we both have that we both need. And women are more emotionally intelligent, I would say. Or maybe that's more our intelligence. I'm going to go with it because I like the way it sounds.
Sounds good.
We're basically emotionally superior. But I do think that women kind of are the emotional compass of a relationship. And that comes with a different responsibility. So my question is what do you think the meeting ground should be? Is it with men? Because men are different and they're like you said, they like to bond over actions. They like to do things. They're not really, like you said, they can get emotionally flooded. But yet they still need to be challenged to be able to use their words to work through emotion. So what do you think that ground is to where you're not overwhelming them or too nagging or too emotionally, like you said, flooding them, but yet kind of coming, what expectation, I guess, for men where they should meet you halfway and vice versa? You know what I mean? Those middle, and I'm sure it's individual, but I'm just curious about those.
Well, I think a couple things to think about in that way is that women are just generally more verbal than men, and so they have more verbal arsenal, which can overwhelm men quicker in some ways, not because they're not emotionally intelligent or not capable.
Yeah, I just like saying it because it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, you enjoy that.
Oh, I sure do. Yeah. Yeah.
She likes to feel superior.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Look at me. I'm elitist.
But women are the first to recognize emotional distance in a relationship. They feel it first. And when they recognize emotional distance in a relationship in some way, they are more sensitive to it and they want to close the gap. And our brains, we're hardwired to attach. We all want to attach. Mm. But women might recognize it earlier, then they may pursue that emotional closeness.
Mm.
But unfortunately, they tend to pursue it with what I call attack. It's nag, lecture, scold. You know, the most dreaded words men hate to hear is, we need to talk. Because they mean, like, I'm in trouble. It's going to take a while.
Yeah.
So women recognize emotional distance. So they might start by lecture, nag, scold, question.
Mm.
Why don't you? Why can't you? We should. Why haven't we? Type of thing. And
right.
And so then you might get into these patterns of attack, withdraw, or attack, attack, or withdraw, withdraw. And really, they're all bids for emotional closeness.
Mm.
But we just go about it in ways that don't work.
Okay.
And that's kind of what my focus is, you know, is helping people understand these automatic reactive cycles that we get in to try to get closeness and end up getting distance.
Right.
Yeah.
And replace that with something else.
Yeah, so, and I think that's why, you know, men sometimes wonder, you know, because a woman will come up and say, you know what, I want a divorce, or I want this and I want that, and or we need to talk. And the guy's like, I thought everything was fine, you know? I mean, there's nothing wrong here. And because I think, like you said, the women are more in tune with what's going on, with the distance and, and that, you know? So that's why, you know, I mean, you'll have men, you know, and they're caught in surprise, you know, like, what do you mean? You know, I thought things were fine. And I know I was guilty of that as well, you know, so.
No, it's funny because you should be here to referee me and Sarah. I'm like, what say Sarah? And he's like, well, I don't know, you're just being sensitive. I'm like, you're just stupid. I'm like, no, it's not that bad, but it gets there. It's funny. You should be here on the show to referee. It'd be good, huh? She should be referee. It's like kind of translating it for us.
Next time you have a conflict, I'll come in.
Yeah, we'll be like, hold on, it's like 3 a.m. Hey, look, we're having a show tomorrow. But I guess my question is this. It sounds like, or correct me if I'm wrong, the woman is learning how to kind of control her end of it, or manage it, like you said, which I think is responsible, and learning how to meet him in the way that he can receive it, right? And to get the right results.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's all positive and it's the right thing to do. But what about the man's responsibility in it? Because my fear or concern is that when you have a woman that's constantly kind of honing her stuff inward, and she's redirecting it, and she's getting so savvy at how to communicate and get these results. But when does the guy learn how to kind of do that into things? Because I can kind of feel that what if she does have a breakdown, and what if she does have a time where she doesn't really manage it the way it should be, and he has to deal with, oh my gosh, I'm overstimulated, I can't handle this, go away. You know, where's the part where he has to learn too? You know what I mean? Because I feel like sometimes the expectation becomes now the woman just has to constantly kind of, you know, shut down the woman thing or whatever. And I think it's smart, but at the same time, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we want men to share the responsibility for the closeness in the relationship and learn some tools too. There's two things I teach, two ways of talking to women that I teach men, and it seems to be difficult for them to say it exactly the way that makes women feel better. So if you're going through a difficult time and you're trying to tell your significant other how you feel, and what he needs to say is, how can I help right now? How can I help right now?
Mm.
Or what do you need from me right now? Not like, what do you want me to do? That's
right.
Very different.
Yeah.
How can I help right now? And then the woman will just say, well, I need you to listen. And you're like, okay. Because you know no one ever listens themselves out of a relationship. And,
yeah, that's funny.
And you're like, okay. And then you'll say, and then you want to validate what you heard. You want to say, yeah, I understand that's true for you. Even if it's not true for me, if it's true for you, it's valid.
Right.
And I call that the disarming technique. I try to teach that to my husband. I'm like, honey, disarm me. If you do that, this will be over in 30 seconds. If you don't, you're in for a challenge.
I love
here.
It. I love
that's
it.
True, yeah.
I love it. That's cute. You're like, look, I'm reaching, you know.
I can tell you exactly how to do it. You're going to just agree with me and say, that must make you feel, and then we'll be done.
Yeah, there you go.
But if you start explaining, then I'm just going to, you know, go after the explanation
in different
ways. Isn't
it so important for people, I think on both ends, to feel validated and to feel, because to them, I think what it is one of my biggest complaints that I've had with family or whatever is, you know, just even though we don't see it eye to eye, this is how it's affected me. And I just want to know that you care that I feel this way, basically.
That's
all you really want.
That's the basic thing that women want. It's much simpler. And if they want something more, they're able to articulate it.
Mm-hmm.
And men want to help. They try to fix things. And so they start hearing things. They're like, what do I do? How do I fix this? What do I do wrong? And that floods them because they're not sure where to go in and where to help.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And women and men both have to be aware of what we call a harsh startup. If you start the conversation harsh, 99% of the time you'll end it harsh.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just get sucked into it, you know, and I try to disarm, but it doesn't work.
How do you do it, Sam? How do you try to disarm?
Well, I guess when I do try, it does work, you know, but I don't know. I'm just like, you know, when you're right. I mean, you know, when you approach it in that way, you just, that's the direction the argument's going to take, you know, and you're going to hate each other at the end, you know?
Yeah. You're going to amplify the conflict. You're going to feel worse, and then you'll just kind of peter out and calm down, and then you have more history of conflict, and you're more triggered easier.
Right.
Mm. And you get to that place of being aroused a lot faster.
Right. Mm.
But the disarming technique will change your life. You know, I guarantee you, it takes about 3 months of practice to get it, but once you get it, you'll be able to disarm most conflicts pretty quickly.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how would you disarm a conflict? I mean, what would you say? What would you do?
The first thing you do is you find some truth in what the person says and you agree with them. Mm. You find some point of agreement. So say, Sam, you said to me, Patty, you're not a good listener. And I know that I listen really well. And I want to say, what do you mean? I'm the best listener. And you're like, well, not really, because I was trying to tell you something. I'm like, yeah, well, most of the time. And then we're off to the races arguing our truth, right?
Uh-huh. Mm. Right.
But if you say that, and I don't really believe that's true, but it's true for you, or you wouldn't say it to me, I would say something, well, you're probably right. I'm probably not listening to you the way you need me to listen to you right now. Because why would you say it otherwise?
Right.
So by agreeing with you, you can't attack me again. You can't give me any more information because I already agreed with you. And then the second step is to empathize and say, I imagine that doesn't feel very good.
Mm.
And then the third step is to probe. How do you need me to listen to you right now?
That's really smart. And I like how you said you're like listening to you in the way that you need me to, because you're not saying that you weren't listening. You're just saying clearly the way I'm doing what I'm doing isn't working for you. Mm-hmm. And you're acknowledging the distance there.
Right.
I think that's pretty smart, because I think it would also be kind of like, you know, it would be just as stupid, or I don't know if that's a dumb word to use, but to be like, yeah, you're right, I'm a bad listener, because you're not. You know what
I
mean?
Right.
Because that would be like, you know, just kind of pacifying, or it could be kind of just enabling that
patronizing
person. Yeah. But to be able to identify that there's a gap there, I think that's pretty smart. I'm going to use that.
Are you?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. Okay.
Watch out.
You'll have to report back and let us know if it worked.
But I got to tell you, because I'm doing this online dating thing. Okay. One of the things I love is I like to be with a man. I like to be with a man. It's taller, handsome. No, a guy that can handle a good fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean like a below the belt kind of angry, tear you down type fight, but a good debate.
Mm-hmm.
I like something that can really verbally spar a bit and be quick like that. And I like that fire that comes with it. And I would love to kind of be able to, you know, meet somebody that has those capabilities, you know?
Yeah.
And not everybody's into it, but, you know, like that kind of lawyer type banter. Yeah. I think it's a blast. You know, I don't want to disarm that.
No.
I like to get in there and get my little jazz, and they're like, yeah, you know, and even say stuff that's not true on purpose just for fun, see what happens.
That sounds like, you know, kind of verbal competition. It's like competing, but verbally, and having fun with it.
And it escalates very quickly, you know, and then you start saying things you'll regret later.
No, I mean, everybody's personality is different.
For me, it's an aphrodisiac.
Even on a friend level, it's fun, you know. I have a really good roommate, and, you know, it's not really her thing, but I do it with her anyway.
There's a lot of people that enjoy that. It's just knowing when does it not be fun? When is all of a sudden you're like, ooh, that didn't feel good.
Yeah.
Or I'm ready to stop now and cuddle. And he's like, no, I'm winning. Let's go some more. You know, let's verbally spar some more.
Yeah.
When you turn it off, do you know? Do you just have a stopping point?
I think it just depends on the person. I mean, I try to be sensitive to where people are, but I also like the challenge, too, because I think I've enjoyed people kind of pushing me a little bit further beyond what's comfortable. And then you go, oh, wow. You know, like, for example, my roommate, who she's from Canada, and she says culturally they just avoid conflict. They're very, very polite, more so culturally speaking. And that people don't really, she's like, coming to America, everybody says what they feel all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it's just sort of different. And so she says she's learned a lot from our chats about not being afraid to have disagreements and to kind of have a little conflict, you know, isn't necessarily bad. So I kind of like to push it a bit, you know, but not to a point where it's personal.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like a violation of the person, you know what I mean?
Well, conflict, other than Sam, people who have conflict in relationships are very successful. Conflict itself doesn't hurt relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because all relationships have conflicts. Because I always like to say, if two people are exactly the same in a relationship, one of them isn't needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And conflict stimulates us. It helps us grow and it helps us express ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's really not the conflict that causes relationships not to succeed.
Mm.
You know, we need some conflict. It's how we work things out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Now, in your practice, what are some of the common problems that people come to you with?
You know, this is interesting because when we think of problems that people come with, say a relationship problem, depression, anxiety, work problems, stress problems, change problems, but the reality behind all those external problems, people come with the same basic problem, and that's emotional distress around their problem. Because you could be going through a divorce and be happy, like, ooh, I'm free.
Right.
Or you could be going through a divorce and be really, really emotionally having a difficult time adjusting to it.
Right.
So people come to me because they have three basic levels of feelings. And the first is anxiety and fear of any sort, worry.
Right.
And the next one is depression or sadness or grief of any sort of the sort of low moods.
Mm.
And the other one is anger, frustration, irritation, anger. So it's anger, fear, or depression. And I call that the unholy trinity of negative affect.
Yeah.
Mm.
And they come with that around something external.
Right.
Mm. But they don't really come for the external problem. They come for the internal response to the external problem.
Mm. I see.
It's hurting them. It's causing distress. And they don't want to feel that distress. They want to come back to more optimum functioning. So it could be a gamut of external problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the trigger that sets them up to be upset. And that's what I work with.
I see. Okay.
So do they come in thinking, hey, I need help fixing the external.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. We'll get to that. But first of all.
Yeah, we get to the external because we use that to see what it's triggering internally and then connect with their feeling internally to kind of their history, the way they always feel. Because if you come in feeling angry, I guarantee you felt angry many, 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 many times in similar situations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And we kind of find out how anger then is a common response for them and then help them move from these automatic emotional reactions to these conscious responses.
Right.
You're responding to your world and you learn how to self-soothe and you learn how to regulate your emotions so that you're not kind of laid low by them, that you can still function at an optimal level.
Right,
yeah, like not being controlled by those.
You're still going to feel it, but you don't want to be controlled by it.
Yeah.
You know, worrying
all the
time. Because
I wouldn't be human. I mean, if something's bad happening, you're going to have
angry all the time or sad all the time or a lot of time. It just interferes with your ability to function.
Right, right. Now, if someone has like depression and it's, let's say, more like a chemical thing and stuff. I mean, do you get to the point where you can't work with them until they're medicated?
No. Typically not. But if it's if I identify this as a biochemical depression, then I will immediately refer them. I work with psychiatrists to a psychiatrist for medication to support that emotional regulation.
Right.
But even then, they still are thinking a certain way about their lives.
Right.
That we can work with. They're still reacting certain ways behaviorally, laying down, not getting up, not doing things. Because depression is really the ultimate form of self-absorption. And I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings
totally
who are depressed.
Agree.
Because
totally
you're
agree.
So focused on yourself and your feelings, and you feel so bad, you can't really get out of yourself.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
like a black hole, right?
Yeah, it's like a black hole. So even medication can't change the way you think. It just sort of gives you a cushion in terms of your emotional affect.
That's if you're not stable. I mean, if you're not functioning and, you know, you're not stable, you know, you're suicidal or whatever, I would imagine you want to medicate the person first.
Yes.
Because probably anything you say to them is not going to make sense, right?
That's exactly right.
You're going to hit a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, you know, I mean, I can totally see that, you know, someone would probably get depressed about the fact that they're depressed as well.
Yes.
You know, and that would make it even worse. You
well, I feel like, especially living in L.A., it's just, let's just be honest, the U.S., it's like, I think it's an over-medicated society. I'm by no means a shrink, and I don't have all the nuts and bolts. But just from casual observation, I feel like we have so much, yet we're so self-involved, and we're so pissed, and we're so sad, and nothing's enough. You know what I mean? And there's an epidemic, you know? And I think, I feel like, it is that there is such a there's such narcissism, and I think that people think they just need to draw inward more to figure it out, but really the answer isn't inward, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's more outward. It's more like getting outside of yourself, really helping people, really pouring into someone else's life, and then you realize there's kind of this cause and effect reaction to where you kind of feel lifted because you're not really focused on you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, I think, kind of, I mean, maybe not the application, but I feel like in a way it's simpler than people realize. Because I've had really good friends that have been on medication for a long time, and they're still chronically sad.
Yeah. Right.
Do you know what I mean? Right. They're still kind of trying to fix themselves. I'm like, is your biggest legacy in life going to be you trying to fix yourself?
Mm-hmm.
When there's life all around you going on, and I don't say that with judgment. It's just kind of more, I think people are buying into something that's not real. Meaning, you know, like there's just this... And it's almost like chic to be, oh, I'm bipolar now. I'm just, not that those things don't exist, but do you know what I mean? Like, in a, kind of taking it to a place where it's just another way to kind of, you know, look at yourself.
Yeah, but, you know, I think you are being judgmental and stuff. And, you know, because I think many people, just like when you have diabetes or anything like that, you have some kind of physical problem.
Let me ask you
this. You need
to
address it with medication.
Well, let me ask you this, Sam, because I'm not saying take medication out of the equation.
Right.
I'm kind of with what she's saying. There's a place for it, meaning to stabilize so that you can work on the stuff that's really going on. So I'm not saying get rid of medication. Mm-hmm. But what I am saying, though, is if somebody has been – there's a condition of the way you think and of your heart where if you're so self-focused, mm-hmm. okay, that can happen – that can turn into many different things. This is just my opinion.
Yeah.
And that can lead to depression because you're so self-focused and it becomes a black hole. So hear me out.
Right.
If you're so self-focused and then you become kind of caught up in yourself and then you get sad and you get more sad, you can't pull out, and now you're in your own crazy dark dungeon of your own world, I would think that chemically it's going to throw you off. But it's not the chemicals, in my opinion, that's thrown you off. It's the fact that you kind of set something in motion that's out of control now, and the byproduct now is you see a chemical... it's kind of like the chicken or the egg kind of thing. And I have a really good friend of mine who... I believe she should be on meds. I mean, it's one of these girls that she just, in her own strength, has not been able to really pull out. And and she's so opposed to medication. And I'm like, well, I think it could maybe help you at least pull out so that you can then get the help on the other ways, you know. But what I'm really saying is that I think kind of as a blanket statement, generalizing society,
mm-hmm.
and I do know too many people. I don't know how many people you know, but I have too many friends that have just been struggling with depression and on medication and nothing's different.
Yeah, well, sometimes the medication is not the correct one. I mean, I know that it can take a while, but you know, you mentioned about being self-centered or very self-involved when it's a depression, but you know, the thing is, when depression can sometimes get painful, maybe even physically painful.
Yes.
And you know, if you have a physical pain, that's all you can focus on.
It's like having the flu.
If
you have the flu, you know, it's still that same self. It's not a pejorative self-absorption. It's not you're not being pejorative when you say that.
I don't know that word. That's a big word for me.
Like judgmental.
Oh, okay.
The depression, it becomes self-absorption in the sense that the actual physical depression is so painful that you can't get out of yourself.
Right.
And you isolate and you get depressed. And we need, you know, psychotropic medications. They're very efficacious. They're very effective. And we need them, and people need them.
Right.
And they need other things too.
Right.
You know, they need other things, you know, a new focus, a way to talk through their feelings, to identify some of the triggers while they're on medications, because therapy and meds together are more effective than one alone.
Exactly.
And for biochemical depression or bipolar disorder and many of the disorder, you really need medication to treat it effectively.
Right.
Can I be as bold to say this? I know you're not going to like this, but because I have too much personal experience with it. I mean, I have friends and I have a sister that took her life and was depressed and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But personal experience that I've seen firsthand is I think a lot of people are looking for identity. They're looking for purpose. They haven't found it. So they're kind of always looking inward, and it's like a black hole. And so at the end of the day, I think some people like being depressed because at least they have something to focus on, because they don't – I'm not saying everybody, and I'm not trying to villainize, but I do think – I'm not buying that everybody's a victim. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I think some people just they're chronically – they like being ill. They chronically like the kind of their – even the attention that they get from themselves.
Well, that sounds very unusual. I don't know how
I don't think it is, though. I think that there's people that have been so – I mean, I've lived with it. I've known too many people that even if they got help, it's like they – this is a condition that they've been in for so long that this is comfortable. And
there's some depressions that are difficult to treat. Other depressions can be treated. And, you know, we can treat depression. We can help people feel better who are depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
There's treatments out there that work. Medication, therapy, other types of somatic treatments, body treatments. There's different treatments. So if anybody who's listening who's depressed, I would really urge them to get a consultation with a psychiatrist or a psychologist and find out what would be best for them. Because it is treatable. Nobody needs and deserves to live with depression.
Right, right. And it's not easy, you know. I mean, the thing is that I'll come out and admit that I'm bipolar, you know, and it's not by by label, but by the fact that for many years I've struggled with manic depression, and it can get very dangerous. I mean, bipolars are more prone to suicide than just people that are just depressed, you know, because the depression of bipolar is a lot more profound. So, and, you know, so I've tried medication for many years and nobody ever got it right, you know, until finally somebody did and it changed my life. Mm. I mean, look at me now. I don't even think of myself as bipolar, but if I just stop taking the medication, forget about it.
Have you done that before? You've stopped and then you've seen it like
both yeah, away? Yeah. You deteriorate.
You do. Mm.
You really do, you know.
The right meds are important.
Yeah, and that's why I can speak from experience, you know. I mean, you've seen people and stuff, but I can tell you it's like almost physically painful to be alive, you know. And
well,
it's not about being a victim, and it's not.
No, maybe not for you, Sam. And I'm not. I'm
no, but I'm talking in general. Also, is that I don't think it's about being a victim. I think it's about the fact that you don't understand why you feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, there's reasons why you're not thinking correctly. You're not thinking in a healthy manner. But the problem is that there's something wrong with you. Something is hurting you. Something's not all right. And until you fix that, you can't focus on other people.
I'm saying, you know? both exist. I'm not saying that, like, everybody that struggles with it is you know.
No, but you say the country is over-medicated. I mean, what do you say based on?
Just living in L.A., I think culturally people are basically, they've got a problem. They don't want to work on it. They're like, let's pop a pill. I mean, I'm sorry, that's not brain surgery to look around and see it.
Right.
And that's that is a reality. I'm not saying everybody that takes meds is taking it for the wrong reason or doesn't need it. I'm not saying that.
Right.
But culturally, I think we live in a microwave generation where people want results right away. They don't want to do the work, and they want a pill. And I think that living in a land of actors, which I do acting and stuff, you see a lot of people that it's all about them all the time, and they are working their own business, and it's all about them, me. And depression kind of goes hand in hand with that. And I've struggled with depression. I mean, it's not like I'm above it, but what I'm saying is I think that there has been, in some ways, culturally, an attitude of, you know, just self-centeredness that can bring about depression, and then also a sense of, you know, really not wanting to really get to the root of it, but kind of, you know, popping the pill, or just some people like to be in the place of I'm sick. And I know that because I've lived with that. I've seen it way too much.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in our society a lot. I mean, but I'm not saying that, you know, medication doesn't have a place, and I'm not saying that these aren't real problems for people too at the same time. I'm really kind of talking more about looking at it from topical and seeing kind of cultural trends. And I mean, that's why I brought it up too, is to see if you've noticed that or...
Well, you know, looking at the research, and this isn't exact, but it's close. 100 years ago, we saw about 1 in 25 people were depressed, clinically depressed. And now it's 1 in 5
really?
Suffer some depression
wow.
in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems to be across all industrialized countries. And nobody really knows why. You know, if we say why, we're just kind of putting out a hypothesis or an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We don't
right.
really know why
that's
the case. So if you're seeing more depression, it's because there is more depression within the society, and we don't really know why.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, do you think it might be because it's a very individualistic society and we don't focus as much on, like other cultures, on family and friends and that sort of thing? So a lot of people are lonely.
And that you have a point there. I don't know how much that would contribute, but it might be a factor, because we know there are no happy hermits.
Right.
There's no happy hermits unless you have a personality disorder that's called schizoid personality disorder. You like to be alone.
Yeah.
But you don't. There's no happy hermits. We need people. We need relationships. Remember, our brains are wired. We need attachments.
Relational,
and we need relationships. And I'm really interested in this field called positive psychology. It's studying, you know, happiness and doing research on, let's look at people not that are depressed. Let's look at people who are generally happy. And what do they have in common? What do they do differently?
I'll tell you what I do. I will. I have
what do you do?
A million roommates.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it's frustrating and you have to compromise all the time. But one of my roommates, I like share room type roommates, okay? we're all actors. We're trying to go after the dream, right?
Yeah.
She's
pretending to be in college still.
Well, you know
what?
Having
fun.
Yeah. Come on. I mean, you make sacrifices to go after the things you want
of
in
course.
Life, and you live within your means. So yeah. I have no complaints. But
it's one of these things where, you know, she just left to go to Canada, and now we're down to three roommates versus four. And I've got to tell you, it's totally like, it's been good, but I'm like, wow, I totally miss her. And we have the best chats and living, and then we, and then on top of the million roommates, we have dinner parties like two or three nights a week sometimes, people over bringing stuff. And I think relational is the way to go. I mean, not necessarily that you have to live in a commune. You know, I don't want to say hippie.
Well, you're an extrovert. Yeah. It gives you energy to be around people.
Yeah, it does. It actually does. Chemically, it does. Totally does.
Sure.
But I've really noticed that we kind of invite, every time we have people over, it's sometimes the oddest oddballs. And they're usually so grateful, and people light up. And even if people aren't really their thing, you know, there's this sense of just energy takes over. And people desire intimacy. They want to be known. They want to be known, and they want to know. And we just, people let their hair down, and we just, I'm telling you, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Even when things aren't great, they're still really good, because I'm like, well, you know, friggin' spaghetti night, and we're going to play the friggin' limbo and truth or dare, whatever. I'm not saying the limbo or truth or dare, but there's just, just that community, it makes it so fun. It makes it so fun. Because I lived out here by myself at first, in the heart of LA, and trying to go after the dream and not knowing how to do it, because it's the most abstract career, because there's no blueprint, there's no right or wrong way to do it, and you have to find your way as you're going. Doing that by myself with no friends, no family.
That had to be hard.
Oh, girl, let me tell you. I worked at Starbucks. It means I worked at the morning shift. I had to be there at 4:30 in the morning, which means I woke up at like 3:50. 4:30 in the morning, I got off around noon. And then you're like, oh, I have the rest of my day. No, because I woke up at 3 a.m. So then you sleep for 4 hours. And then you wake up, you're like, oh, it's kind of like dinner, lunchtime. And then you eat. And then you read a book and you go to bed. I did that for months, and I didn't have any friends. And I mean, talk about being in just a really weird place.
I would think that would be very deadly for you, really.
Yeah,
extrovert. You need people. I can tell you're gregarious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was
charismatic.
It was just crazy. It was crazy. But I really got to kind of experience living a life a little bit more solitude, and how that affects, you know. And I've gone through different seasons of my life where I've been in, you know, more isolated situations where you don't have that community, and how it really does, certain things lie dormant in you. It says it takes a community to know a person, because Sam's going to bring different things out in you, then I'm going to bring different things, and I need him to see certain things in you, vice versa. And so I think that's why we really need each other. And I think it's just all about people, to be honest.
Yeah, we're very social animals, you know.
Yeah, we need attachments. It's interesting, because when we look at the happiness research and what's predictive of happiness, and it's only a slight prediction, but it's not money. You know, a certain amount of money makes people happy when their basic needs are basically fulfilled, but more money doesn't increase happiness. Mm-hmm. But the only two predictors that seem to increase happiness a little bit is a secure relationship or a spiritual belief. And I think the reason for that is because you don't feel like you're alone.
Yeah. Right.
If you have a relationship, because we're all going to find adversity, you know, small and large in life. If you have that person to share it with, it breaks it. You don't feel alone. Or if you have a spiritual belief, you don't feel alone as you confront the stresses in your life.
Right. Yeah. I've read something that married people are generally happier.
They
are. Is that correct?
Yeah. They're generally happier overall, married people. The population, if you want to look at suicide predictors, that has the most difficulty are older white men have the highest increase of suicide.
Oh. Because they're alone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
That's so sad.
It is.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's very difficult, let me tell you. You know, I mean, depression, I can imagine anxiety, these type of things are, you know, I mean, you can't go about your life when this is like there all the time, you know?
It's like carrying a weight. It's
exactly.
A huge burden.
And, you know, I mean, I've had some terrible times in my life because of it, you know? And you tend to let everything go, and sometimes self-sabotage, you know? And it's definitely not anything to be taken lightly, you know?
Well, I mean, I've been through it. I mean, maybe not the same thing you've been through, but I've definitely been through a time where, I mean, the simplest things, getting out of bed, I mean, it was
just like barely functional.
Yeah, I was right out of high school, and I had no stability, and not that it's any different than now. But now it's like, whatever, I kind of expect it, but no stability. And it was definitely a dark time too. Every time I had an idea, it was like something came over me that crushed it. And it was like every time I had a plan of escape, something came over me and crushed it, to where I just stopped kind of dreaming and stopped having goals, because it just felt like everything was the rug was pulled out from underneath my feet before I even got a head start. So then you just stop kind of get, you stop trying and you give up kind of. And mm-hmm. I went through like a really, it was very bizarre. It was bizarre because it was something you can't, it's intangible, so you can't explain it. Yeah. It's probably very different from person to person, but it was like a really weird. And I also look at things through a spiritual context too. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some spiritual elements going on that I was in a lot of transition and just some things were going on that were just, it was bizarre. It was like an internal battle, nonstop struggle. And so I it's not like I'm heartless towards it. I totally have an empathetic side to it. Don't let that be overshadowed by the fact that I see an abuse of these words. And I see a culture that is, to me, just really looking for purpose and identity. And because of those things, you know, I think when you have to labor for things in life sometimes and you have to actually be other-centered, you see less depression, in my opinion. That's what I think. And when you live in a society that's all self-focused, individualistic, as you say, and narcissistic, I think it's easier to fall into depression. Mm-hmm. When all you need sometimes is just to get outside of yourself and maybe go talk to somebody that's less fortunate or help somebody else. And it's not that it's necessarily applications that easy, but I feel like sometimes it can be that simple, is what I'm saying.
Well, there's some, you know, one of the things I help with my clients that are dealing with depression, and this is just one small thing that we do, but we, from research, we know it works, and that's the gratitude journal or being grateful, because it's actually like your brain actually shifts the way it processes when you add gratitude. And if you could just, like, you know, try it yourself every night before you go to bed, just either write down or repeat to yourself five things you're grateful for. And it doesn't have to be like major, like I'm grateful for something big. I'm grateful I'm in a comfortable bed and I really am comfortable and I get to go to sleep right now. You know, I'm really grateful, you know, that I just had a great cup of tea. It doesn't have to be large.
I so agree with that.
And if this, what this does, it begins to shift your focus. And what you're talking about for depression, focusing outside of yourself, it is something that does work, because whatever you focus on gets bigger. If you focus on your sad feelings and you focus on how you feel hopeless, you're going to feel what?
Hopeless.
Right, more hopeless. You're not going to all of a sudden feel good.
Yeah.
And you're not going to feel like focusing on other things. But we encourage our clients to do it and see how, what's different.
Right.
Start thinking what you're grateful. You're grateful at least you have treatment. You're grateful that you have a psychotropic medication that's helping you. You're grateful that you can talk to somebody about it. Mm-hmm. And you start shifting your focus, because it really changes your brain. It changes your brain. Mm-hmm. And you begin to activate different neural pathways in your brain to increase your mood.
Right.
So one of the things you could just do every day if you're depressed is start finding small things you're grateful for and just say, well, I'm just really grateful that I can, at least can stay at home in bed today.
Right, yeah.
You know,
for
and
sure.
I believe in that, because it produces hope.
It produces hope and actually increases the endorphins in your brain, which are the feel-good chemicals,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
It's now, very, I'm sorry, go on.
No, I mean, have you seen people that actually like complete treatment and then they can go on and live a healthy life, or is it pretty much an ongoing thing for the rest of your life?
Well, I think, you know, I work in a personal growth model. It's not like treatment has a beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. We treat a particular problem or a particular mood or a particular obstacle, and when that's removed or uplifted, and then you're like, okay, you know, Patty, I'm done. I don't really need them. I'm saying fine. And then maybe you get married, you come back, you're like, I'm adjusting to marriage. So we deal with that. Or I had a child, or I'm having a little bit of a backslide. I have clients that are bipolar that I treat regularly, who are very stabilized, very successful.
Right.
And but they like to continue therapy just to look for any markers that they might, their mood might be changing or shifting. And I know about meds. I don't prescribe meds, and you know, as a psychologist, that's not my to recommend. Though I certainly know about them and study them as well. So I'm like, how are your meds? Do you need adjustment? It looks like you may be a little tweak. Maybe you need to talk to your psychiatrist about that. I can see it because I'm looking for it.
Right,
I'm looking for the stability.
Yeah.
And you probably know you need structure in your life. You need good bedtimes. You need not to go to extremes and things to keep that mood stable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Except I really don't have to work hard at it, you know? And that's the thing. I'm saying, I mean, I do the therapy thing, but I definitely feel the medication has made me not focus on myself anymore. Now I can feel like, live like a normal person. And
I would have never known that about you.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying, you know, because for a few years, I've been very stable, you know, because finally the doctor found like a good cocktail, you know, medication.
Right.
And that's, yeah,
right.
And it works. And it works, you know. But the thing you got to remember is not to stop it, because it just happens too many times when people stop the medication and then they kill themselves, you know, because they can't deal with the problem anymore. And it's very tempting to do it because, like, I feel okay. So, you know, so you ask yourself, well, why do I need the medication? I'm feeling fine. But it's because of the medication you're feeling fine. But
right. But
I have to agree with you in every word that I've read, and based on personal experience, the meds and the therapy work best when
yes. You
do it both.
Right.
Because I think even when it's a chemical thing, you need to learn how to think in a positive way. You know, because if you're someone who's suffering from depression, then you're always going to think negative thoughts and stuff, you know, and you don't know that pattern of suddenly thinking positively about things. So that's why I think, you know, the therapy is like an integral part of every recovery, I think, from mental illness.
Yeah, because we're not really trained how to think about our thinking. That's called metacognition, thinking about thinking. Most people aren't thinking about how they're thinking. They're just thinking.
Right.
And so you train people to start looking at what they're thinking about, and then you recognize that some of these thoughts are distorted. They're not truth. You know, black and white thinking, all or nothing, like all men are insensitive and all women are not. It's just not true. It's idiosyncratic to the individual.
Right.
So when you're thinking, you become aware of your thinking, and some thinking will take you down this pathway of worry, fear, depression, and anxiety, and amplify it. Other thinking will move you in a different pathway.
Right. Mm.
So you need somebody to help you understand that and then kind of hold your foot to the fire and help you do it.
Right.
Because we'll know it, but we don't want to think that way. It kind of, you know, our brain just wants to go back to what it's always done.
Yeah.
We have to retrain it. I do brain retraining, basically.
That's
I retrain people's brains to think differently.
It's very fascinating, not to Bible beat you guys, but just because I'm seeing the correlation between, like, the Bible talks about to renew your mind by the word of God, and which is very, I see correlations between that with thought replacement and behavior modification, and really, like you're really talking about the structure of the way people think, because I think by nature we all have these, like, kind of brokenness in us, you know, these defaults of just wirings off or who knows what's been passed down from generation to generation, or what's biological and environmental, and that I think God really gets to the heart of it, which is, you know, the way a man thinks, you know, that's how he's going to be.
James Allen wrote a little book called As a Man Thinketh. Have you read that?
I haven't, no. Is it right up that?
Yeah, it's written, I know, quite a while ago, maybe 100 years ago or so. As a Man Thinketh. And it's part of it is biblical, and part of it, you know, is used in New Age type metaphysical transformational psychology.
Yeah.
But as you think, so you are.
It's so interesting to see the correlations. And the Bible also goes on to, it talks about meditation and talk about meditating. It says whatever's pure, good, loving, peaceful. It goes down.
Think on that.
Think upon these things.
Right.
And I think it's more than just, I want a bunch of Christians that are like Hallmark. I think it's about, like you said, elevating our thinking and our moods and our perception. And then always, it says, always have gratitude. Bible talks about really giving praise and giving thanks continually in your mouth. And then it sometimes says it's a sacrifice of praise, because you're giving praise when you don't feel like you have it to give and you don't want to, but it's not just for God's benefit, but it's for us too, because it's something about the transitioning in our mind and our heart. So I think it's just profound hearing it from a clinical kind of scientific, but then seeing how it correlates spiritually too. You know what I mean? I think that's really fascinating.
It is fascinating. You can really correlate a lot of positive psychology with spiritual truths and teaching.
Yeah.
You know? Throughout the ages.
Well, we are out of time, Patty. And how can people get a hold of you if they want to?
They can go to my website. It's Dr. Patty Johnson, drpattijohnson.com, and email me from there, or just go to drpjohnson@live.com.
Okay, sounds good.
Yay.
Patty, you've been a lot of fun. Very
thanks for sharing. Very great.
Very interesting.
I've enjoyed it.
And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All the best to you, and good luck in L.A.
Thank you.
And that's it. We're totally out of time, Kira. So we'll keep some of the Bible stuff for tomorrow, okay?
Okay, don't worry.
All right. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.
You have been listening to Sam and Kara in the Morning, which airs every weekday from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, originating from the Los Angeles Talk Radio studios. If you have questions about the show or would like to inquire about sponsorship opportunities, please direct all correspondence to info@latalkradio.com. Sam and Kara in the Morning is a production of LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.